Chapter 9. A Cup of Tea. Once in her dressing room, Elaine hurriedly changed out of her riding clothes with the help of Esanda, the white-haired pensioner she had chosen for her maid. The slender, dignified woman was a trifle slow-moving, but she knew her job and did not waste time chattering. In fact, she seldom said a word beyond suggestions on clothing and the comment given every day that Elaine looked like her mother. Flames danced atop thick logs on a wide marble hearth at one end of the room, but the fire did little to take the chill off the air. Quickly she put on a fine blue wool with patterns of seed pearls on the high neck and down the sleeves, her silver-worked belt with a small silver-sheathed dagger, and the silver-embroidered blue velvet slippers. There might be no time to change again before seeing the merchants, and they must be impressed at the sight of her. She would have to be sure Brigitta was there. Brigitta was most impressive in her uniform, and Brigitta would take even listening to merchants as a break. By the heated knot of irritation resting in the back of Elaine's head, the Captain General of the Queen's Guard was finding those reports heavy going. Fastening clusters of pearls in her ears, she dismissed Esanda to her own fire in the pensioners' quarters. The woman had denied it when offered healing, but Elaine suspected her joints ached. In any case, she herself was ready. She would not wear the coronet of the daughter heir. It could stay atop the small ivory jewelry chest on her dressing table. She did not have many gems. Most had already been put in pawn, and the rest might have to go when the plate did. No point worrying about it now. A few moments to herself, and she would have to leap back to duty. Her dark-paneled sitting room, with its wide cornices of carved birds, contained two tall fireplaces with elaborate mantels, one at either end, which did a better job of warming than the one in the dressing room, though here, too, the carpets layered on the white-tiled floor were necessary. To her surprise, the room also contained Halwyn Norrie. Duty had leaped at her, it seemed. The first clerk stretched up out of a low-backed chair as she entered, clutching a leather folder to his narrow chest, and lurched around the scroll-edged table in the middle of the room to make an awkward leg. Norrie was tall and lean, with a long nose, his sparse fringe of hair rising behind his ears like sprays of white feathers. He often minded her of a heron. Any number of clerks under him actually wielded the pens, yet a small ink stain marred one edge of his scarlet tabard. The stain looked old, though, and she wondered whether the folder hid others. He had only taken to holding it against his chest when he donned formal dress, 2 days after Mistress Harfour. Whether he had done so as an expression of loyalty, or simply because the first maid had, was still in question.
"Forgive me for being precipitate, my lady," he said, "but I do believe I have matters of some importance, if not actual haste, to lay before you."
Important or not, his voice still droned.
"Of course, Master Norrie. I would not want to press you to haste."
He blinked at her, and she tried not to sigh. She thought he might be more than a little deaf from the way he tilted his head this way and that, as if to catch sound better. Maybe that was why his voice almost never changed pitch. She raised hers. A little. He might just be a bore, after all.
"Sit, and tell me these matters of importance."
She took one of the carved chairs away from the table and motioned him to another, but he remained standing. He always did. She settled back to listen, crossing her knees and adjusting her skirts. He did not refer to his folder. Everything on the papers in it would be inside his head, the papers there only in case she required to see with her own eyes.
"Most immediate, my lady, and perhaps most important, large deposits of alum have been discovered on your estates at Dunabar, the first quality of alum. I believe the bankers will be, less hesitant regarding my inquiries on your behalf once they learn of this."
He smiled briefly, a momentary curving of thin lips. For him, that was near to capering. Elaine sat up straight as soon as he mentioned alum, and she smiled much more broadly. She felt a little like capering herself. Had her companion been anyone but Norrie, she might have. Her elation was so strong that for a moment she felt Brigitta's irritability wane. Dyers and weavers devoured alum, and so did glassmakers and papermakers, among others.
The only source for first-quality alum was Gildan, or had been till now, and just the taxes on the trade had been sufficient to support the throne of Gildan for generations. What came from Tyr and Arafel was not nearly so fine, yet it put as much coin in those countries' coffers as olive oil or gems.
That is important news, Master Nori, the best I've had today.
The best since reaching Camelin, very likely, but certainly the best today.
How quickly can you overcome the banker's hesitation?
It had been more like slamming the door in her face, only not so rude. The bankers knew to a man how many swords stood behind her at the moment and how many behind her opponents. Even so, she had no doubts the riches of Alum would bring them around. Neither did Nori.
"Quite quickly, my lady, and on very good terms, I believe. I shall tell them if their best offers are insufficient I will approach Tyr or Cairhien. They will not risk losing the custom, my lady."
All in that dry, flat voice, without a hint of the satisfaction any other man would have.
"It will be loans against future income, of course, and there will be expenses. The mining itself. Transportation. Dunabar is in mountainous country and some distance from the Lugard Road. Still, there should be sufficient to meet your ambitions for the guards, my lady, and for your academy."
"Sufficient is hardly the word if you've given over trying to talk me out of my plans for the academy, Master Nori," she said, nearly laughing. He was as jealous of Andor's treasury as a hen with one chick, and he had been adamantly opposed to her taking over the school Rand had ordered founded in Camelin, returning to his arguments time and again until his voice seemed a drill boring into her skull. So far, the school consisted of only a few dozen scholars with their students, scattered about the new city in various inns, but even in winter more arrived every day, and they had begun to clamor for more space. She did not propose giving them a palace, certainly, yet they needed something. Nori was trying to husband Andor's gold, but she was looking to Andor's future. Tarmon Gaiden was coming, yet she had to believe there would be a future afterward, whether or not Rand broke the world again. Otherwise there was no point in going on with anything, and she could not see just sitting down to wait. Even if she knew for a fact that the last battle would end everything, she did not think she could sit on her hands. Rand started schools in case he did end breaking the world, in the hope of saving something, but this school would be Andor's, not Randall Thor's. The Academy of the Rose, dedicated to the memory of Morghaes Trakand. There would be a future, and the future would remember her mother.
"Or have you decided the Cairhien and gold can be traced to the dragon reborn after all?"
"I still believe the risk to be very small, my lady, but no longer worth taking in view of what I have just learned from Tar Valon."
His tone did not alter, but clearly he was agitated. His fingers drummed the leather folder against his chest, spiders dancing, then still.
"The White Tower has issued a proclamation acknowledging, Lord Rand as the Dragon Reborn and offering him, protection and guidance. It also pronounces anathema on anyone approaching him save through the tower. It is wise to be wary of Tar Valon's anger, my lady, as you yourself are aware."
He looked significantly at the great serpent ring on her hand, resting on the carved arm of the chair. He knew of the split in the tower, of course. Maybe a crofter in Salizen did not. No one else could fail to by now. But he had been too discreet to ask her allegiance. Though plainly he had been about to say the Ammerlin Seat instead of the White Tower. And the light alone knew what in place of Lord Rand. She did not hold that against him. He was a cautious man, a quality needed in his post. Elida's proclamation stunned her, though. Frowning, she thumbed her ring thoughtfully. Elida had worn that ring longer than she herself had lived. The woman was arrogant, wrong-headed, blind to any view except her own, but she was not stupid. Far from it. "Can she possibly think he will accept such an offer?" she mused, half to herself. "Protection and guidance? I can't imagine a better way to put his back up." Guidance? No one could guide Rand with a barge pole.
"He may possibly have accepted already, my lady, according to my correspondent in Cairhien,"
Norrie would have shuddered at the suggestion he was in any way a spymaster. Well, he would have twisted his mouth in distaste, anyway. The first clerk administered the treasury, controlled the clerks who ran the capital, and advised the throne on matters of state. He certainly had no network of eyes and ears like the Ajahs and even some individual sisters did, but he did exchange regular letters with knowledgeable and often well-connected people in other capitals, so his advice could be current with events.
"She sends a pigeon only once a week, and it seems that right after her last, someone attacked the Sun Palace using the One Power."
"The Power?" she exclaimed, jerking forward in shock. Norrie nodded once. He might have been reporting the current state of street repairs.
"So my correspondent reports, my lady. Aes Sedai, perhaps, or Ashaman, or even the Forsaken. She repeats gossip here, I fear. The wing housing the apartments of the Dragon Reborn was largely destroyed, and he himself has vanished. It is widely believed that he has gone to Tar Valon to kneel before the Ammerlin seat. Some do believe him dead in the attack, but not a great many. I advise doing nothing until you have a clearer picture."
He paused, head tilted in thought.
"From what I saw of him, my lady," he said slowly, "I myself would not believe him dead unless I sat 3 days with the corpse."
She almost stared. That was very nearly a joke. A rough witticism, at least. From Halwyn Norrie. She did not believe Rand was dead either. She would not believe he was dead. As for kneeling to Elida, the man was too stubborn to submit to anyone. A great many difficulties could be surmounted if only he could bring himself to kneel to Egwene, but he would not do it, and she was his childhood friend. Elida stood as much chance as a goat at a court ball, particularly once he learned of her proclamation. Who had attacked him, though? Surely the Seanchan could not have reached out to Cairhien. If the Forsaken had decided to move openly, that could mean worse chaos and destruction than already faced the world, but the worst would be Ashaman. If his own creations turned on him... No. She could not protect him, however much he needed it. He would just have to fend for himself. "Fool man," she muttered in her head. "He's probably marching around with banners just as if no one tried to kill him at all. You had better fend for yourself, Rand Althor, or I'll slap you silly when I get my hands on you."
"What else do your correspondents have to say, Master Norrie?" she asked aloud, putting Rand aside.
She did not have her hands on him yet, and she needed to concentrate on trying to hold on to Andor. His correspondents had a great deal to say, though some of it was quite old. Not all the writers used pigeons, and letters given to the most trustworthy merchant could take months to come across land in the best of times. Untrustworthy merchants accepted the post fee and never bothered to deliver the letter. Few people could afford to hire couriers. Elaine had a mind to start a royal post, if the situation ever allowed. Norrie lamented the fact that his latest from Ebu Dar and Amador were already overtaken by events that had been the talk of the streets for weeks. Not all the news was important, either. His letter-writers really were not eyes and ears. They just wrote the news of their city, the talk of the court. The talk of Tyr was of increasing numbers of sea-folk ships that made their way through the fingers of the dragon without pilots, and now crowded the river at the city. Of rumors that sea-folk vessels had fought the Seanchan at sea, though that was purely rumor. Ilion was quiet and full of Rand's soldiers, recovering from a battle against the Seanchan. No more was known, even whether Rand had been in the city was in question. The Queen of Saldaea was still on her long retreat in the country, which Elaine already knew about, but it seemed the Queen of Kandor had not been seen in Chachin for months either. And the King of Shinar was supposedly still on an extended inspection of the Blight border, though the Blight was reported quieter than any time in memory. In Lugard, King Roedron was gathering every noble who would bring armsmen, and a city already worried about two great armies camped near the border with Andor, one full of Aes Sedai and the other full of Andorans, now also worried about what a dissolute wastrel like Roedron intended. "And your counsel here?" she asked when he was done, though she did not need it. In truth, she had not needed it in the others. The events were too far away to affect Andor, or else unimportant, just a view of what was occurring in other lands. Still, she was expected to ask, even when they both knew she already had the answer. Do nothing. and he had been prompt with his replies. Murundi was neither far away nor unimportant, yet this time he hesitated, pursing his lips. Nori was slow and methodical, but seldom hesitant.
"None in this regard, my lady," he said at last. "Normally I would advise an emissary to Roadron to attempt sounding out his goals and reasons. He may be fearful of events north of him, or of the Aiel raids we hear so much about. Then again, though he has always been unambitious, he may have some enterprise in northern Altara, or in Andor under the circumstances. Unfortunately..."
Still pressing the folder to his chest, he spread his hands slightly and sighed, perhaps in apology, perhaps distress. Unfortunately, she was not queen yet, and no emissary from her would get near Roadron. If her claim failed and he had received her envoy, the successful claimant might seize a swath of Murundi to teach him a lesson, and Lord Luon and the others had already seized territory. She had better information than the first clerk, though, from Egwene. She had no intention of revealing her source, but she decided to ease his distress. That must be what had his mouth wrinkled, knowing what should be done and not being able to see how to do it. "I know Roadron's aims, Master Nori, and he aims at Murundi itself. The Andorans in Murundi have accepted oaths from Murundian nobles in the north, which make the rest nervous. And there is a large band of mercenaries, dragonsworn really, but Roadron thinks they are mercenaries, who he has hired in secret to sit and provide a menace after the other armies are gone. He plans to use those threats to bind nobles to him tightly enough that each is afraid to be the first to break away when the threats are all gone. He may be a problem in the future, if his plan succeeds. For one thing, he will want those northern lands back, but he presents no immediate problems for Andor." Nori's eyes widened, and he tilted his head first to one side, then the other, studying her. He wet his lips before speaking.
"That would explain much, my lady. Yes. Yes, it would."
His tongue touched his lips again.
"There was one other point mentioned by my correspondent in Kyrian, which I, forgot to mention. As you may be aware, your intention to claim the Sun Throne is well known there, and has large support. It seems that many Kyrians speak openly of coming to Andor to aid you in gaining the Lion Throne so you can take the Sun Throne sooner. I think perhaps you do not need my advice concerning any such offers."
She nodded, quite graciously in the circumstances, she thought. Aid from Kyrian would be worse than the mercenaries, for there had been too many wars between Andor and Kyrian. He had not forgotten. Halwyn Nori never forgot anything. So why had he decided to tell her, rather than let her be caught by surprise, perhaps by the arrival of her Kyrian supporters? Had her display of knowledge impressed him, or made him fearful she might learn he had held back? He waited on her patiently, a dried-up heron waiting... on a fish?
"Have a letter prepared for my signature and seal, Master Nori, to be sent to every major house in Kyrian. Begin with setting out my right to the Sun Throne as the daughter of Taringale Domodred, and say that I will come to put forward my claim when events in Andor are more settled. Say that I will bring no soldiers with me, as I know that Andoran soldiers on Kyrianan soil would incite all of Kyrian against me, and rightly so. Finish with my appreciation of the support offered to my cause by many Kyrianan, and my hope that any divisions within Kyrian can be healed peacefully."
The intelligent would see the message behind the words, and with luck explain it to any who were not bright enough.
"A deft response, my lady," Nori said, hunching his shoulders in a semblance of a bow. "I shall make it so. If I may ask, my lady... have you had time to sign the accounts?"
"Ah,
no matter. I will send someone for them later."
Bowing properly, if no less awkwardly than before, he prepared to go, then paused.
"Forgive me for being so bold, my lady, but you remind me very much of the late queen, your mother."
Watching the door close behind him, she wondered whether she could count him in her camp. Administering Camelin without clerks, much less Andor, was impossible, and the first clerk had the power to bring a queen to her knees if unchecked. A compliment was not the same as a declaration of fealty. She did not have long to mull the question, for only moments after he departed, three liveried maids entered, bearing silver-domed trays that they placed in a row on the long side table standing against one wall.
"The first maid said my lady forgot to send for her midday meal," a round, grey-haired woman said, curtsying as she gestured for her younger companions to remove the tall domes. "So she sent a choice for my lady."
A choice. Shaking her head at the display, Elaine was reminded how long it had been since breakfast, eaten with the rising sun. There was sliced saddle of mutton with mustard sauce, and capon roasted with dried figs, sweetbreads with pine nuts, and creamy leek and potato soup, cabbage rolls with raisins and peppers, and a squash pie, not to mention a small plate of apple tarts, and another of tipsy cake topped with clotted cream. Mists of steam rose from two squat silver pitchers of wine, in case she preferred one sort of spicing over another. A third held hot tea. And, pushed scornfully into a corner of one tray, was the meal she always ordered in the middle of the day, clear broth and bread. Rena Harford disapproved of that. She claimed Elaine was thin as a rail. The first maid had spread her opinions. The grey-haired woman put on a reproachful face as she set the bread and broth and tea on the table in the middle of the room with a white linen napkin, a thin blue porcelain cup and saucer, and a silver pot of honey, and a few of the figs on a dish. A full stomach at midday made for a dull head in the afternoon, as Lini used to say. Her opinions were not shared, however. The maids were all comfortably padded women, and even the younger pair looked disappointed as they departed with the remainder of the food. It was very good broth, hot and lightly spiced, and the tea was pleasantly minty, but she was not left alone with her meal, and her thoughts that perhaps she could have taken a little of the tipsy cake for long. Before she had swallowed two mouthfuls, Dialin stormed into the room like a whirlwind in a green riding dress, breathing hard. Setting down her spoon, Elaine offered tea before realizing there was only the one cup she was already using, but Dialin waved the offer aside, her face set in a dire frown.
"There's an army in Braem Wood," she announced, "like nothing seen since the Aiel War. A merchant down from New Braem brought the news this morning. A solid, reliable man, Tormund, an Ilianer, not given to flights of fancy or jumping at shadows. He said he saw Arafelin, Kandori, and Shainarans in different places. Thousands of them altogether. Tens of thousands." Collapsing into a chair, she fanned herself with one hand. Her face was touched with red, as if she had run with the news. "What in the light are Borderlanders doing nearly on the border of Andor?"
"It's Rand, I'll wager," Elaine said. Stifling a yawn, she drank the rest of her tea and refilled the cup. Her morning had been tiring, but enough tea would perk her up.
Dialin stopped fanning and sat up straight. "You don't think he sent them, do you? To help you?"
That possibility had not occurred to Elaine. At times she regretted letting the older woman know her feelings for Rand.
"I cannot think he was, would be that foolish."
Light, she was tired. Sometimes Rand behaved as if he were king of the world, but surely he would not... What it was he would not do seemed to slide away from her. She covered another yawn, and suddenly her eyes widened above her hand, staring at her teacup. A cool, minty taste. Carefully she put the cup down, or tried to. She nearly missed the saucer altogether, and the cup toppled over, spilling tea onto the tabletop. Tea laced with fork root. Even knowing there was no use, she reached out to the source, tried to fill herself with the life and joy of Sidar, but she might as well have tried to catch the wind in a net. Birgitta's irritation, less hot than before, was still lodged in a corner of her mind. Frantically, she tried to pull up fear or panic. Her head seemed stuffed with wool, everything in it dulled. "Help me, Birgitta," she thought. "Help me."
"What is it?" Dialin demanded, leaning forward sharply. "You've thought of something, and by your face it is horrific."
Elaine blinked at her. She had forgotten the other woman was there. "Go," she said thickly, then swallowed heavily to try clearing her throat. Her tongue still felt twice its size.
"Get help. I've been poisoned."
Explaining would take too much time.
"Go!"
Dialin gaped at her, frozen, then lurched to her feet, gripping the hilt of her belt knife. The door opened, and a servant hesitantly put his head in. Elaine felt a flood of relief. Dialin would not stab her before a witness. The man wet his lips, eye darting between the two women. Then he came in, drawing a long-bladed knife from his belt. Two more men in red and white livery followed, each unsheathing a long knife. "I will not die like a kitten in a sack," Elaine thought bitterly. With an effort, she pushed herself to her feet. Her knees wobbled, and she had to support herself on the table with one hand, but she used the other to draw her own dagger. The pattern-etched blade was barely as long as her hand, but it would suffice. It would have, had her fingers not felt wooden gripping the hilt. A child could take it away. Not without fighting back, she thought. It was like pushing through syrup, but determined even so. Not without fighting. Strangely, little time seemed to have passed. Dialin was just turning to her henchmen, the last of them just closing the door behind him.
"Murder!"
Dialin howled. Picking up her chair, she hurled it at the men.
"Guards! Murder! Guards!"
The three tried to dodge the chair, but one was too slow, and it caught him on the legs. With a yell, he fell into the man next to him, and they both went down. The other, a slender, tow-headed young man with bright blue eyes, skipped by with his knife advanced. Dialin met him with her own, slashing, stabbing, but he moved like a ferret, avoiding her attack with ease. His own long blade slashed, and Dialin stumbled back with a shriek, one hand clutching at her middle. He danced forward nimbly, stabbing, and she screamed and fell like a rag doll. He stepped over her, walking toward Elaine. Nothing else existed for her except him and the knife in his hand. He did not rush at her. Those big blue eyes studied her cautiously as he advanced at a steady pace. Of course, he knew she was Aes Sedai. He had to be wondering whether the potion had done its work. She tried to stand straight, to glare at him, to win a few moments by bluff, but he nodded to himself, hefting his knife. If she could have done anything, it would have happened by now. There was no pleasure on his face. He was just a man with a job to do. Abruptly, he stopped, staring down at himself in astonishment. Elaine stared, too, at the foot of steel sticking out from his chest. Blood bubbled in his mouth as he toppled onto the table, shoving it hard. Staggering, Elaine fell to her knees and barely caught the edge of the table again to stop herself falling further. Amazed, she stared at the man bleeding onto the carpets. There was a sword hilt sticking out of his back. Her leaden thoughts were wandering. Those carpets might never come clean with all that blood. Slowly she raised her eyes past the motionless form of Dialin. She did not appear to be breathing. To the door. The open door. One of the remaining two assassins lay in front of it, his head at an odd angle, only half attached to his neck. The other was struggling with another red-coated man, the pair of them grunting and rolling on the floor, both striving for the same dagger. The would-be killer was trying to pry the other's fist from his throat with his free hand. The other. A man with a face like an axe, in the white-collared coat of a guardsman.
"Hurry, Birgitta," she thought dully. "Please hurry."
Darkness consumed her.